Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We gather here around our kitchen table once a week here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. Ah, Donna, we had a bit of a summer rain. It sort of drove that, with the smoke in the air, the wildfires in Canada.
I hate to disabuse you of that, but I've been watching the air quality maps.
Yeah.
It's still lingering over us.
Oh, my.
It's just not as bad.
So a little reminder that, yes, we are part of the whole planet.
Yeah, that air kind of circulates wherever it wants to.
And we have to learn to share that. Yes, there's summer thoughts. Summer solstice is coming up. And
yes, the longest day of the year. And after that, it's all downhill again.
Oh, we have a nice summer ahead of us. There's fireflies. And I have, okay, it's June. I am missing the June bugs. They must be someplace.
Oh, but I have them. They smack against my window every night.
Oh, good. Yeah. I have June bugs who have mosquitoes and fireflies and other little flying things. But so summer. Well, today we're going to be talking about the Iowa Prairie. The Iowa Prairie, there's not much left. Do we even know what we're losing? Can we do anything to get it back? Joining us at our kitchen table today is Shelley Buffalo. She's a member of the Meskwaki tribe, and she has the title of Colonial Pathfinder. And she runs a consulting company called Water Panther. And she's a member of the board of the Great Plains Action Society. She has a lot to say about prairie and local foods and food sovereignty and all the good stuff. Welcome. Welcome, Shelley Buffalo.
Hello. Happy midsummer day to you, or almost midsummer day, right?
Yes, very good, very good. So one reason that we have Shelley with us today is to kind of highlight the fact that there's going to be a Practical Farmers of Iowa a field day coming up.
Open to the public, yes.
Having to do with prairies at the Neil Smith National
Wildlife Refuge.
Uh-huh. And for more information on that, you can go to practicalfarmers.org/fielddays, and the date is Wednesday, June 28th, and the session
10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
It will be run by Shelley.
So Shelley, tell us what you're going to do down there on that day.
Oh, first I wanted to correct my title. My title is The Colonial Pathfinder, not Colonial Path.
Oh, right. Now, we've found the Colonial Paths, haven't we?
Oh, sorry about that. The.
Yes. This is to a certain extent, you know, this is why I'm hosting this field day about rematriating the prairie, is because of the, you know, colonial pathway that we have been following. Has, you know, led us to, for one thing, you know, a climate change on a level that, you know, I think most people can't wrap their head around, as well as a great extinction of, you know, species. We just don't, you know, we're losing biodiversity by the minute. And so, and honestly, like, you know, I can't remember what physicist or scientist said this, but it's true, is that you can't fix something with the same energy that created it.
Ah.
And that's why, decolonizing, you know, that's why I believe that, you know, if we start with the way that we think, the way that, you know, it's like our mindset, mm-hmm. and all of those biases that we filter, you know, our perceptions through.
Biases that we probably don't even see.
Yeah, yeah. As once again, like folks, you know, most people aren't aware of it. And like people think of themselves like, I'm a good person. I'm a good, you know, I'm a good member of society. I'm, you know, I'm a community member. I care about my community, and all of those things, can be true. And at the same time, also be true that people are, you know, have these, kind of implicit biases, right? That forms the way that they build community and interact between, you know, with different groups within their community and society, and with like biodiversity in general.
So you're going to, and you know, you're taking on this trip to this particular place because, well, tell us how the field day came about.
Well, a couple of years ago, I was a new group of webinars came out from Practical Farmers of Iowa. And there was one that I was really excited to listen to about restorative grazing on the prairie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was deeply offended. You know, it may have only been like a couple sentences into the webinar because the person... and this was, I guess, a prairie expert or grazing expert, you know, that was presenting. They said about, you know, basically this is, you know, grazing practices that uses, a lot of rotation, heavy grazing, but on short periods of time on the land. So rotational / regenerative grazing. And, you know, I guess this person was an expert in that field. And one of the first things they said was the settlers had it right.
Oh, my. Okay. React to that. What kind of tripped your trigger about that statement?
Well, even what did he mean when he would say something like that?
Or she, actually.
She.
They, yeah, that's why I'm saying they, because then it's just like, So what they were referring to is this idea that the settlers had grazing practices that were more, you know, like we started out with, like, for example, grass-fed beef and pastured pigs. But like
that's all anybody did.
That is so totally incorrect, as well as the fact that, like, what they committed was erasure, because it's like, come on, Indigenous people have been in relationship with the land and all the ecologies for hundreds of thousands of years. And there's even, you know, the books that I read, I'm currently reading a book about prairie, Iowa's historic prairie, and they talk about the history of the Indigenous people, and they quote the flawed land bridge theory, which is like, there were people here before the land bridge, and the land bridge theory itself is so incredibly flawed because they're, you know, for humans to be able to migrate across that land bridge during the Ice Age, right?
Are we talking about the Bering Strait land bridge theory?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
So that's and it's that people populated. This is the theory that people populated North America coming from Asia, right? And that is merely a theory and not true.
Yeah,
apparently.
Yes, that there was a physical corridor through the Bering Strait that was like 13,000 years ago. The problem with that is that folks couldn't have migrated through that region because there wasn't any type of like biosystems that could provide like food, sustenance, and shelter and clothing while migrating through that region. So that right there is that theory is like really problematic. Also, that, like, you know, even the archaeological evidence is that, you know, that these archaeologists are finding is, you know, human remains across the Americas that are like hundreds of thousands mm-hmm. years old. So first off, there's that. And then, you know, the fact that, like, in this PFI Prairie webinar, right away they said the settlers had it right. Well, first off, like, that completely, that's what we as Indigenous folks called erasure, which is just presenting this idea that the people...
There was nothing here before the white people came, right?
There was nothing here except for a few, you know, cavemen running around in furs, right? And which Europeans, you know, saved through Christianity. And so instead of, you know, the reality is, like, you know, we, the Indigenous folks, had a deep knowledge of ecosystems and had a very complex and very intelligent way of interacting with those systems. In fact, like, now Indigenous folks are by you know, the prairie experts and such, see Indigenous folks as a keystone species, right? That when you remove that species, then the system at least part of the system collapses. And the other thing about the settlers had it right, which is just like this idea that the settlers were doing all pasture systems for their beef and their pork, is like, no. The very, very early on in the American colonies, once the colonists learned how to grow corn, that's what they fed the animals, because these animals were being raised in the Americas and then being shipped back to Europe to feed those European markets. In fact, like, one of the reasons that we've had so much destruction, exploitation, and extraction of the Americas is because, you know, the Americas are, you know, were colonized. And so the whole, you know, the whole structure of colonization is based on exploitation and extraction. And so the settlers came with plows. They plowed up the prairie. They cut down the savannas and the forests. The settlers came with their seeds and their idea, mm-hmm. you know, of what the land should look like and what should be grown there, what should be raised there, how to farm
well,
there.
And these ideas everything. That they brought with them were based on the market economy of what, you know, the European market needed. More food, things like cotton, all of the export crops were based on the European model of an economy.
Well, and two, you know, you say what the European economy needed, and so much of it really wasn't about what was needed. You know, the beaver, the close, you know, kind of near extinction of the beaver was because the popularity for the beaver fur hats, right, which is those tall top
yeah,
hats.
A beaver hat.
As well as like feathers. Feathers became very mm-hmm. fashionable. So it was like so much of what was extracted was like for a very, you know, for fashion ultimately. But also, if you think about Europe, why were there so many masses of Europeans immigrating to the newly, you know, well, to the colonies? First, they were the colonies, and then later became the United States and Canada, Mexico. Why? Because, like, you know, over the course of time, as the aristocracy was able to kind of take power over everything, all of, you know, government, the army, everything, then what happened was enclosure, which is laying claim to all of the land, you know, title and deed.
Privatizing everything.
Everything as owned and controlled by the aristocracy. So, you know, so many of the immigrants came over here because in Europe, they didn't have a pot to bleep in,
yeah.
you know, let alone, the communal lands that used to be like the village green and all of that stuff, the stuff that was communal that, you know, people could, graze their cattle, their sheep, all of that stuff. That was like very quickly becoming a remnant of the past because of enclosure. You know, there was counties that you couldn't even walk through anymore because of enclosure. Like all of those paths and the little roads that used to go through forest and lands were then fenced off and said, no trespassing, you know, and you couldn't even hunt.
That's true. That's true.
Unless you were part of the aristocracy. So how are you going to even, you know, so that's, unfortunately, that's the energy that was brought here. And I have, you know, I do have compassion for, on my mom's side are, you know, that's the settler side, and my dad's side's the Meskwaki side. And perhaps that's why I have, you know, I guess I have an ancestral compassion for the type of trauma that folks were coming out of. Unfortunately, what they did is they brought it here and then they enacted it on the indigenous folks.
Yeah, they were mistreated in Europe. So they came here and everyone wanted to be part of the aristocracy, which was the dream or the plan, where Jefferson wrote about everybody will have their own little farm that'll be their own. Well,
it was the gigantic get rich scheme. We're still living it.
We still are living it. And unfortunately, like you said, it wasn't about even taking care of a chunk of prairie. It was highly, highly changed by the plow.
Yeah, there really wasn't. The early surveys that were done for modern folks, you know, studying these land surveys, you know, that trying to figure out, you know, Iowa before settlement, what the land was like, is, you know, there has to be a lot of deduction because the folks doing these surveys did not see any value in the prairie plants, right? Or, you know, the wetlands. They did not see any value in the beaver. The beaver was seen as a nuisance, for example, instead of another keystone species, which is, you know, an ecology builder, you know. And so even in the early surveys, it's, you know, you have to do a fair amount of deduction to be able to figure out just what Iowa was like before the settlers and the plows hit it. And their plows.
Right.
Plows didn't do it. You know, it's just an object to the settlers' plows.
So these are some of the things that you're going to talk about and explain on the prairie tour?
Well, I think that, you know, okay, so a little bit about Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge. For one thing, like I chose Neil Smith because, you know, specifically I wanted to talk about rematriating the prairie and the oak savanna. And so Neil Smith, I believe it was 1991 when Neil Smith was established. And what they've done is, you know, transformed former cropland to tall grass prairie.
And it's about 6,000 acres, so it's big.
It's big. They do have some bison. I'm not sure how many. It's not a huge herd, but they do have bison. And so for Iowa, about 85% of pre-settlement Iowa was once native tall grass prairie, and now it's less than 1%. And, you know, with the loss of the prairie, so there's bird populations, you know, that also have disappeared, for example. This was, you know, food cover and breeding habitat for local and migratory birds. And I think about that when I see the trenches being dug and new tiling systems being mm-hmm. put in. You know, I mean, every year you drive across Iowa, you see that. It's just Iowa is tile crazy. And tiling is used in agricultural practices to drain any standing water off the land. And it's really destructive. It's accelerating the destruction.
It's true. And I find it makes it, you know, because it's under the ground, so you don't see it. It's like there's this hidden stuff going on that, you know, you're driving along the highways and it's green, it's beautiful, but you don't see it, you don't feel it, but it's there. It's really, it's a hidden level of destruction in our landscape.
Yeah, and to me, it's not green and beautiful. You know, the millions of acres of corn and soybeans. You know, because it's, you know, to me, you know, I see that landscape as lifeless and desolate. I see, you know, the type of biodiversity that was there before settlement was, you know, and once again, the unseen, the biodiversity mm-hmm. in the soil mm-hmm. underground, and then the biodiversity above the soil, the biodiversity in the air. So it's, you know, this is like in the millions, you know, of life forms. And now it's reduced to a monocropping system. So one year, the only life form that's allowed there is GMO corn. The next year, the only life form that's allowed there is GMO beans. You know, so I don't see that landscape as beautiful. It triggers, you know, just a lot of trauma in me, a lot of hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Because these are all my relatives. Like when we talk about ecological systems and biodiversity from the indigenous point of view, these are all my relatives and they're gone.
That's true. We've all of this stuff that we think we're on top of because we are modern agriculture. Yes, sirree. We forget that we are part of things. We're not the masters of things at all. Well, I'll take a little break here, and we'll come back to talk more with Shelley Buffalo. Lots to talk about the prairie, what's been lost, and maybe looking at our world in a different way. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. The Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Shelley Buffalo about restoring prairie. Not, she has a better word, I think, than restoring prairie. It's called rematriation of prairie, which has a whole different feeling to it. She is a member of the Meskwaki tribe. And you talk about being a member of the world, which sounds actually in these times a lot better than being just a consumer of this world. Talk about the relationship of Native and Indigenous people to prairie, because they just didn't let it alone. They managed it. There was ways to get sustenance from the prairie.
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, this is another, it was a couple years ago, Meskwaki hosted the Food Sovereignty Summit, Great Lakes Indigenous Food Sovereignty Summit. I'm trying to remember. It's GLIFS, yeah. And the acronym for that. And so this was, this food summit was just incredible. And it was like probably the healthiest 5 days of eating in my entire life. Because this is all indigenous foods, all, you know, what we call now, you know, organically grown, sustainably harvested. And it was just incredible. And because I know, you know, Don Alana show, it's a kitchen show, so we should, like, get back on that food.
Right, we're all about what we eat.
The food theme here. So in any type of these ecosystems, so I do want to say Meskwaki tribe, we are originally from the St. Lawrence Valley, which is like now upstate New York and, you know, Quebec, that whole area. And so we are, you know, we're basically refugees, you know, from pushed east in because of, you know, the colonization of the East Coast, or push west, sorry about that. Mm-hmm. So the Meskwaki tribe is not a prairie tribe. Mm. We are like our, the kind of, our historic ecology is best described as the woodland fringe. And we are Great Lakes woodland Indians. So our, you know, our food systems is once again, you know, also very regional. But as we moved, as we migrated west through, you know, pretty much the south side of the Great Lakes is that our where our migratory path is. You know, we're coming out of the eastern woodlands and into more prairie systems. But of course, out east, instead of the, you know, the, you know, with, like we still had bison, we had woodland bison.
And they're smaller. Are they smaller?
No, they're actually larger.
Ooh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So we were familiar with bison and elk, but yeah, as we came west, you know, we adapted to systems, you know, the ecosystems that we were coming into. But this is still, Iowa is kind of still the part of the Great Lakes system, at least, you know, kind of the eastern half, even though we don't, you know, the state doesn't butt up against the Great Lakes. It's still very much, you know, part of that system. And so people within that system, you know, we, whether you're Meskwaki or Anishinaabe or Ho-Chunk or Dakota, which Dakota is one of the more eastern of the Sioux tribes, you know, we share a lot of our food ways, a lot of those common foods. And of course, one of the major foods is bison. And how do you keep land open? Because you need, you know, for large herbivores, you do need prairie and savannas. And how do you keep those land open? How do you maintain it? You do that through fire.
Ah.
In heavily wooded systems, like I always say, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, squirrel tastes just fine, but a bison or an elk or a moose is going to feed a lot more people than a squirrel. So it's also, you know, it's just a very efficient way to feed ourselves is by, you know, very intentionally managing the landscape primarily with fire. So early colonists reports about life on the East Coast when there was still a lot of tribal folks living in that area is that they would talk about the fires that the Indians set and how the fires were kind of ominous and but it was like a yearly cycle of fire. in over large portions. And now, like, you know, the reason that Canada is having, you know, these huge, huge wildfires right now is because, you know, you remove the keystone species, you remove the indigenous folks that would burn, you know, sections of those areas annually. And not only does it reduce the fuel load, right, but it also does incredible things for the soil. And there's a lot of seeds and things that are, you know, stimulated by fire. So yeah, it's very much, you know, this isn't something that was just, you know, a few thousand years of relationship. This is like a very, very long, long relationship between the people and the land and the ecology.
So how was fire managed on the prairie?
Was it every year?
Or how
a
certain area? And how were the fires contained? Tell us about the mechanics of it.
Well, I think that if you are a prairie expert, you can look at the prairie and you can tell when it needs some fire. Like you can tell, you know, where there's, I guess, you know, the previous year's, you know, kind of like trash, right? Is getting a little bit too thick for really good, healthy regrowth. As well as like the, you know, fast growing, shrubs and trees, you know, start to move in. And that's another, oh, well, this part here needs some fire. Mm-hmm. And, the whole idea of containing fire, it's like, you know, when used as a tool annually, the fire contains itself. You know, the fire is going to burn out those areas that are, you know, that need that, you know, and they're not, and the fires are going to stop at those areas that were, you know, burned the year before or burned the previous year.
Oh, so when they run out of fuel, that's it.
Yeah, they're going to burn out. Yeah. I mean, you can definitely, you know, you can definitely set back fires, in order to, you know, create a fire line. There's a lot of things like that you can do, but like that need wasn't really, you know, to the best of my estimation, mm-hmm. you know, that need wasn't always there. Fire was just allowed to burn. But since it was done annually, you know, selectively in a way that you know, brought about, you know, kind of better health of the land and the soil. Then it's not, you know, it wasn't, so apocalyptic like, you know, the wildfires that we're seeing now.
So currently,
does that help?
Neil Smith, is the reserve managed that way?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, yeah. I mean, you know, they have, you know, they have professional people managing the prairie and the system that do all that stuff. But like, yeah, you can't manage prairie without fire, nor savanna, you know, nor savanna land.
So like with the oak savannas, the bur oak, for example, is fire resistant? Is that how it works?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, you know, those trees evolved with fire, and so those big mature trees. Once again, it's not, you know, fires were used routinely, so you didn't have this buildup of fuels. And as well as like all of the shrubs, like think about, well, you know, out in California, they're using the huge herds of brush coats to go down and take down all of the, you know, shrubby undergrowth, mm-hmm. because, when those forests do catch fire, it's that heavy, undergrowth, all that shrubby stuff that, during drought, especially, you know, just creates this, you know, the fires, instead of burning quickly over the ground, you know, they just stay and they're able to kind of walk that ladder up into the canopy of the mature trees.
So
instead of, you know,
The frequent burns then make the fire not as long and not as hot, and that's how you manage it, basically.
Yeah, the frequent burns was a regenerative system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when before settlement, you know, Iowa is the Iowa soil is there really wasn't anything like it except for, you know, maybe a you know, one or two other parts of the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that tall grass ecosystem. And of course, like the bison herds and the elk and the indigenous people and their use of fire, you know, all of that stuff build up that soil. Like, what was it, you know, Iowa had in some areas, what, up to 9 feet of incredibly rich topsoil. Well, the fire, it's, you know, it's the, you know, that carbon release and the other nutrients released by fire, is like a tremendous soil builder.
Ah, so what did the Meskwaki actually do kind farming on this land as well? Or you, how did you feed yourselves?
Well, we farmed. You can also, this is another way of thinking about it. So this use of fire to maintain prairie and savanna increased the local large herbivore herds.
Besides,
so it's not like
besides the bison.
Well, I'm talking about primarily the bison, mm-hmm. but there's also, you know, there was also elk. So, you know, instead of like the dances with wolves where, you know, the Indians are trying to, you know, following the bison around, you know, really now, folks are starting to understand that these large herds followed us because, you know, we create, you know, we maintain that ecosystem. Think about that fresh regrowth after, you know, after a good burn and how rich and lush that would have been. So,
So basically you were making pastures for them.
Yeah. But I wouldn't want to use the word pastures.
Oh.
Because, you know, pastures are enclosed. You know, and this was, you know, this is maintaining, yeah, a system that increased that large herbivore population. But anyway, we fed ourselves through a combination of farming, even like this relationship with the land that increases biodiversity, that that especially increases the, you know, the large herbivores, specifically the bison. That's, I see that as a farming practice, right?
Oh, definitely.
But also, you know, we're farmers, so primarily our primary crops were corn, beans, and squash. And we're also hunter gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, there's a publication called the Meskwaki Ethnobotany, which was done right around the 1900s, and you know, it includes this list of plants that were used for medicinal purposes. So, you know, we had, yes, we had our gardens, but we also had this incredibly diverse ecosystem where we were able to forage from, hunt from, as well as, like, gather our medicines from.
Do you think that as as the Meskwaki migrated from the eastern woodlands, did they carry some of the seeds that they had been familiar with there here, or... Because it's not the same. Some of the plants, of course, are the same, but not all of them.
I mean, any type of, like, native plants that were already here, you know, if you look at these common medicinal plants, once again, you know, generally they're going to be in this bioregion, right? Mm-hmm. From, you know, if you're going from the east side of the Great Lakes to the west side of the Great Lakes, mm-hmm. you know, Iowa, like our state is where that transformation from woodland, savanna, and then going into that open tall grass prairie, you know, Iowa is where that happened.
Yes, it gradually gets drier.
So Meskwaki were removed to a reservation on Kansas and then Oklahoma, and we came back. And why we came back is, like, we're woodland Indians. We're not prairie Indians.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to come back, and we found a place to settle here along the Iowa River, which more represented, you know, the type of ecosystem that, once again, our plant medicines, as well as, you know, how we were able to, you know, build our traditional lodges from all of those things. But your question was about taking seeds with us. Sure, once again, corn, beans, and squash.
Mm-hmm.
So these are corn, beans, and squash. These are annual plants. They can reseed themselves. I mean, everybody's had like a volunteer corn or bean or squash or tomato or, you know, or even lettuce. Sometimes in my garden, I'll get mm-hmm. a volunteer lettuce from the previous year that bolted.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, yes, you know, we, our Tama Flint corn, which is our, you know, this is our traditional corn. We've had that particular seed for somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 years.
Hmm.
So we can just say roughly 3,500 years. So we definitely brought that seed with us for sure. from where we used to be over in, you know, the St. Lawrence area.
Oh, we're talking to Shelley Buffalo. This is KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. Shelley, I want to ask you more about food and traditional food and maybe not so traditional food. There has been a very unpleasant relationship between the people that came from Europe and the people that were here originally in the Americas. Can you kind of sum up some of that history in the concept of fry bread? What is fry bread?
Fry bread is it's a really simple recipe of white flour, salt, baking powder, and water.
Ah.
That's it. There's food sovereignty folks, indigenous folks, that refer to fry bread as Holocaust bread. And so, because basically, you know, we were, what happened, we were rounded up removed from our lands repeatedly mm-hmm. and pretty much put on concentration camps. Mm-hmm. So our ability to, you know, feed, clothe, and house ourselves, and especially when you're constantly being, you know, pushed off of your villages, where your fields are, where all of your gardens are, you know, where you've long established, a system of taking care of yourself, and constantly being pushed off that land and having to start over again. And then finally, you know, being put on these concentration camps that we call reservations, where, you can barely, eke out, a way to feed yourself. The U.S. would provide these I'm trying to think of the term for it. It's not annuities. It's
commodities. Commodities?
Yeah, well, basically.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it became commodities. It turned into commodities, but it started out as sugar, flour, and I think coffee.
How sustainable?
Native women. Yeah, Native women figured out how to, you know, with what they had available to them. They didn't have ovens. Like, we hardly had anything, you know, but Native women knew how to make a cook fire. And so they created, you know, out of these scant, commodities that we were given, this amazing bread called fry bread. So, and you have to be careful. You know, it takes a lot of skill in handling that dough because you can very easily activate the gluten too much. And so you come out with a frisbee rather than, you know, this like tasty, fluffy bread that's kind of like a savory funnel cake.
Okay, so it's not fried. Does it have oil in it?
It is. Yeah, it's fried in lard. So, you know, the dough is dropped into a hot, hot cast iron skillet full of lard.
And that was for a time sustenance food, white flour and lard? Well, I guess you won't.
Yeah,
you won't
white
starve
flour,
to death,
sugar, but, and coffee.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like, why do we have such high health disparities in Indian country? Why do we have such high rates of diabetes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if we, if we went back to primarily, you know, consuming bison and elk and of course our forage foods and, you know, which is like a lot of berries and things like that. And then corn, beans and squash. You know, we would see an elimination of those diseases.
Oh, yeah. There have been some studies in the southwest of the indigenous, where diabetes is really, really high. And these are desert people. But if they're put back on their indigenous diet, their diabetes levels drop a lot.
It probably would help the rest of us on the planet, too, where diabetes is the problem. Yes,
yeah.
It is.
If we didn't have so much sugar and white flour.
Well, we think about, oh, yes, there's the Native Americans. But you make a thought experiment or you make a statement that actually we all are indigenous and we've all been kind of pushed around. So I heard you give a little short talk after the production of Mary Swander's Squatters on Red Earth, a play that's currently going around. And you mentioned us, you talked about colonization of a lot of us.
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, you know, the European immigrants to the Americas, they basically brought their trauma of colonization here and enacted it upon the indigenous people of Turtle Island. Mm-hmm. If anybody goes back far enough into their, you know, into their ancestral line, you know, they're going to trace it to indigenous people, you know, of where their ancestors came from. And like in respect to Europe, you know, Europe was colonized by Rome. And then when you had the fall of Rome, you had this big power vacuum. And so it was just the Middle Ages were, you know, an exercise in Europeans killing each other. And ultimately, you know, these were folks that, you know, their whole system, their indigenous systems had been destroyed. They had had a foreign religion imposed upon them. Mm-hmm. And then of course, you know, were under these conditions of extraction and exploitation themselves. Mm-hmm. Until that system collapsed. And then what do you have? You know, you just, like I said, you have this power vacuum. And I think like, you know, we really need to get, you know, first off, like, folks really have to, like, take responsibility to heal. I mean, truly heal, you know, the self-healing journey to get on that path. But first you have to be, you know, you got to build up your knowledge and awareness in order to understand, you know, it's like, what am I carrying on my family line? You know, that's just a lot of harm. That's just a lot of trauma. That's, unfortunately, you know, now it's just like, you know, why are we repeating these cycles? And, you know, these cycles are a couple of thousand years old. So yeah. Let's, you know, let's break these cycles.
Yeah, it's hard for Europeans to think back earlier than the feudal systems and the kings and the coming of the, you know, the priests from the Roman Catholic Church. But there were a lot of indigenous people all over Europe way before all of that. But we don't know much about them.
It's hard.
Pre-colonization, you know, there's definitely a lot of stuff in Europe, you know, that the, once again, you know, archaeologists are constantly, you know, investigating and finding out more and finding new, you know, whether it's burial sites, you know, sites that you know, the solstice is here. And so sites that mark the solstices and the equinoxes and, mm-hmm. you know,
Earth peoples.
All of that stuff. I mean, it's there and it shows you, it's just like, you were also, you know, indigenous ultimately, it's, you know, indigenous people are the descendants of the earliest known inhabitants of an area, especially one that has been colonized by a now dominant group of settlers. Like, that's kind of, you know, a really general term. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, like I said, we, you know, all of us can trace ourselves back to indigenous people of, you know, one area or the other. And, you know, over the years, I remember in a fabric store of all places, one young woman approaching me and asking if I was Native. And she started talking about how she, you know, like she doesn't want to be a white person. Like, she doesn't see any value in that heritage, like culture, religion, anything like that. And she's like, you know, she basically said she wanted to become an Indian. And I use like indigenous, Indian, Native American interchangeably. And I have to be conscious about that because like, it's, like, when white folks call us Indians, it's kind of like, no, we can't call each other Indians, but, you know, the polite term would be Native American. But anyway, you know, how she had the desire to just, like, I don't want to be white anymore. I want to be a Native American. And I told her, you know, hey, it's you can't just, like, grab something that you want, you know. And I said, you need to trace your ancestry. Right. There's indigeneity in that. And there are deeper ways of being with the land and knowing also in your ancestry.
That is good advice. Thank you for being with us today, Shelley Buffalo. We are talking to her about finding out more about what really sustains us. And she's going to be giving a talk as part of a Practical Farmers of Iowa Field Day, Wednesday, June 28th. Find out more at practicalfarmers.org. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is, you can come and listen to us at noon and 7 p.m. on Tuesdays. We have music by the Barn Owl Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
Happy solstice, everybody. Eat good food and enjoy life.